hand you. Put those on the table for you. Thank you. Hi, you guys. I'm Susie Donahue. I'm an alcoholic. Susie. My sobriety date is September 29th, 1987. For all y'all that weren't born, that was a rough year, let me tell you. So I've got a home group. It's called There's a Solution in Cary, North Carolina. I love my home group. It's a great place to be. They've loved me a lot and given me a lot of hope. But more importantly, they've shown me how to be a member in good standing. And that's important. And so I'm really grateful. But the greatest gift I've ever been given is the gift of giving to another person this way of life. You know, line by line, word through that big book, I've been able to watch people come alive. I've seen families reunited. I've seen people do things they never thought they could. And I've seen people live miraculous lives. And I've seen the God that came in and visited me come and visit you. There's nothing like it. So just know that. That's the greatest gift. And I met my sponsor my first night in AA, so you'll hear about that. But first, I want to say congratulations to all you guys for your anniversary one more time. I'm telling you, you know, it's really easy to get a resentment and get a coffee pot and start a meeting. It's also very easy to go to another meeting and try to change it or fix it according to your will and actually end a meeting. It happens all the time. So for this meeting to stand firmly and stay grounded in fact, in principle, in honor and dignity, and to be able to have members that have stepped up regardless of how small the numbers got and how big they grew again, and to continue to do that work, you know, in the autonomy of a group like that where they continue to do right action no matter what, that says a lot about who's here tonight. So it's a privilege for me to be here. Thank you. So I want to thank John. I want to thank Lloyd. And this little group of girls, this posse here, my very best friend Leslie is here tonight, and I'm just delighted to be able to see her. So God gave me a Christmas present. I never expected to come here. I never expected to see her this year, and I was given that gift. So that's amazing. And these women all came to hear me. I don't know if they don't know about me, but anyway, they're going to find out. So thank you, guys. Thank you, guys. I'm waiting for God to kind of get here real quick, so we're gonna just start without him right now because I don't feel it yet. It's coming. I can feel that much. But so I was raised in Seattle, Washington, and I told you my sobriety date. So let me clear this up because everybody's trying to do the math, you know. So I came to AA at 27 years old. I'm 64 now. I know I'm not looking too bad for 64. Stay sober, and you too can have all this. Anyway, but, you know, so like I said, I came at 27, and I've been here 37 years, and it's miraculous. If I would have gone somewhere else because life had gotten better not coming to AA, you would have a different speaker, wouldn't you? But I couldn't wait to come here and tell you what God has done for me, what a 12-step program has done to absolutely transform me. You know, I was a young woman. I was raised, you know, in the Seattle area. My father was a doctor and a dentist. He spent a lot of time at the hospital wiring people's mouths shut and building teeth. My mother was she was not a stay-at-home mom. She was a psychologist, so my mother worked full-time when I was a little kid, and that was not common. I was raised by a nanny. I know, not my fault, but I was raised in an upper-middle-class family, don't doubt. I mean, you know, I learned how to golf and, you know, tennis and go to the club and order a cheeseburger and sign my name. It was pretty impressive, I thought. But, you know, my family lived right for a long time. They taught me principles. I wasn't raised like an animal. Do you know what I mean? I knew right from wrong. You know, I learned a good work ethic from my father, especially, and my mom. And, you know, I knew how to live. I was brought into a church. My father's best friend was a Catholic priest. And, you know, we got really close with him. He was a great guy. He came every Sunday to, you know, eat with our family. And I really began to believe that there was a God out there. There was some kind of God out there. And I had prayed to that God because eventually my parents started having a lot of parties at night and a lot of drinking was going on in our home. And my dad's theory, I believe, was like work hard, party harder. You know what I mean? And it was kind of like that kind of thing for a lot of years where they drank at night and it was just fancy beaded gowns and tucks and tails and, you know, getting money for auctions and spending money on the you know, like just crazy things, the Opera Guild and all that kind of nutty stuff. And my parents were very involved in that, but their drinking accelerated quickly. And when I first came to AA, my hand was stuck here, I think with Velcro, and I felt very sorry for myself that I had such a bad family that was so alcoholic, it's their fault that I'm here. I didn't do this, but I found out I was wrong. So, I knew that there was some problems with alcohol. I could see it. You know, my mom was drinking really bad during the day, and my dad would come home and get hammered, and it was rough at my house. And my mom had a little baby, and it became my baby. You know, it was kind of a strange childhood for me because my mom was busy drinking, sort of working, and I was taking care of this kid. So some of my childhood was all about going to school because that's where I learned about, you know, having people tell me I was good enough. And that's where I got all my praises, you know? So I studied harder than anybody. I was the best. And if I wasn't the best, I was a piece of crap. Does that sound familiar? You know? So, you know, I'm either amazing or I'm not. Or I want to be amazing and that was close enough, you know? But, you know, I just really worked hard to try to get some praise. Somebody told me that I was enough. And I always kind of was born with that little chip on my shoulder that I wasn't quite like other people. I wasn't quite as tall. I wasn't quite as smart. I wasn't quite as pretty. I just wasn't quite enough. And I always had that in my thinking from the time I was a very young kid. Now, if you went and talked to any of my friends that grew up with me, they all thought I was super popular, that I was amazing, I was a great friend, and I was very kind. I don't know who they talked to, but, you know, I didn't feel that way. I never wore that kind of a personality out that I remember ever having that. I was very insecure and always thinking about what you were thinking about me. And I lived with that most of my life. So I went to church. I believed in God. I wanted to be a saint or an angel. But I never experienced a relationship with a power greater than myself ever going to church. And nothing against anybody that has. I'm glad that that was your experience. But I went to church a lot. You know what? I mean, a lot, because I sinned a lot. I went a lot of confession. I did everything, you know? I did that a lot, but I never got any kind of relief. And then when God wouldn't do things I wanted him to do, like fix my family, I got a little angry, you know? And there came a day when my older brothers, you know, there was drinking always around my family, but my older brothers, I found out my oldest brother was making wine out in the woods. I was very excited, because alcohol meant growing up, you know, being like the grown-ups. So he was making homemade wine. I thought, that's a start. I'm going to go there. And then my other brother, he was going to the schoolyard with this kid named Sean. Now, that's my son's first name. It's not, don't even go there. But anyway, Sean was my brother's friend, my youngest brother's friend, and he invited me to go to the schoolyard and go drink some beers, and I was taken with this man, let me tell you. So the beer came, and the man, I don't know which was first, but they were Mickey Widemouth beers. I'm sure you don't know what those are, but it's like malt liquor, really strong. And there were four in a pack, and I knew I was getting at least three of those and possibly him. I was pretty certain, you know? It was looking good, you know? So I had one, and I remember feeling like, you know, like there was a sense of ease, like there was a, whew, this is good. I felt the warmth and the excitement. And then after the second one, I was like, yeah, woo, let's go to a bad neighborhood. You know, I mean, I was like, yeah, you know. I mean, and like, you know, my son who's a, you know, he's a grown man now and a doctor, when he has a glass of wine, he just kind of gets relaxed. And sometimes he leaves it on the counter and forgets to finish it. It's really odd, you know. So, but he gets a little relaxed, and then he doesn't want anymore. It's the weirdest thing. I'm like, woo, let's go, woo, come on. And I would get lifted up. So alcohol did something to me and something for me, always. And, I mean, I came alive. And it wasn't that I was taller or prettier or cuter or smarter. I just didn't care what y'all thought anymore. You know, I mean, it was like the big, you know what, you know, like, I can't do it now, I'm at church, I shouldn't do it. But, you know, it was like, basically, y'all think what you want, I'm on my own now, I'm fine. And so they found me like 3 hours later in the woods, they were looking for me. I have this talent for walking off when I'm drunk, very dramatic. Come find me, you know. So anyway, I was in the woods, passed out, I had vomit on one shoe and no shoe, they never did find the other shoe. And my brothers drug me home, and I had no consequence because my family was drinking. You know, so, but a young girl, 12 years old, you would think that would have been a consequence regardless, even if I hadn't gotten caught, that I would have been hugely embarrassed. I mean, my shirt was buttoned funny. Somebody had buttoned it for me, if you know what I mean. So I was very friendly that night, apparently, And those are the kind of things that started to happen quickly with drinking. And, you know, I definitely drank. I drank too much. I vomited. I'm friendly. Hopefully I was friendly before I vomited. I'm not sure. But I'm hoping that was the record of how it went. But my brothers just, you know, they put me back there. But a normal person would have been humiliated, never wanted to go to school, would have hid, would have been so embarrassed. By Friday, I couldn't wait. Friday afternoon, I was already waiting to go up to that school again because I couldn't wait to go and get that feeling. And for me, I became a weekend warrior by the time I was 13 years old. Every weekend, Thursday night on the football game, you know, I couldn't even wait till Friday at the football game. I was already getting, you know, buttered up Thursday night. My brothers would have wine or whatever they were making that week, you know. It was great, you know. And my brother would have something out in the shed that we could, you know, smoke. And everything was, you know, what I thought, this was living large, you know. And I immediately knew. I knew then even that I drank a little bit differently than other people. I knew that I could drink a lot, and I was super proud of it. I mean, it was like a badge of honor. Like this small little Irish Catholic girl can just down them. She can keep up with the boys, you know. I was all impressed with myself, you know. But the problem was, other people weren't so impressed, you know. I'm at the party, and I'm sliding down the wall, you know, at 7:30 at night. You know, it's not a good look. You know, in a dress, by the way. But, you know, or I'm across the pool table and they're all screaming in my ear, Susie, and I'm so blacked out I can't even hear people yelling at me. And they just haul me off and put me in the back of a truck and hope I wake up later. That was the kind of drinking I was doing. And every time I drank till it was all gone and we couldn't get any more. And then if there was any other, you know, shenanigans available, you know, my favorite shenanigan is free. That's my favorite. So I'll take whatever you bring, you know, free. And that's my favorite. So I would do a lot of other party favors just because if something was available, I was so drunk I couldn't say no. And I was always like that. It was that with men. I just loved to drink. It was like the thing that made me most happy was knowing I was going to get a drink. And I remember being in front of the ABC store and just thinking to myself, you know, if they would just open up a little earlier, everything would be okay. And I'm thinking, what kid, what, you know, 13-year-old kid thinks like that? And I've got a guy that's the guy that failed out of high school waiting to buy me liquor, and I'm 13 years old. I mean, my God, I had a child, and I think to myself, Sean at 13, oh, my God, he was nowhere near drinking at the ABC store, you know what I mean, on his way to high school or middle school, you know, but that was who I was. And, you know, then something really tragic happened. You know, I was, you know, doing all this weekend warrior stuff and everything and, you know, lying to my parents all the time. And I was at a football game and they called our last name. And I went up there and a family priest was there, good old, you know, father. And he said, your dad drove off a cliff. He was drunk and killed him. And at that moment, if you listen to most people's story from the podium in Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll hear where we stopped believing, where God disappointed us, where there was some kind of failure that didn't happen or something didn't work out the way we had hoped or had prayed for it, wanted either a sick little sister or a brother that died in a fire or a mother that wouldn't come home or a dad that left Christmas morning and never came back. Those are all the things that we hear at the podium that separates us from God. And at that moment, I barely was able to go to the church the next day and bury my father. And from that day on, I mean, I made a 180-degree turn away from my family, from God, from church, from anything that was principled at all. You know, and I couldn't wait to live that life because I was mad. How could you take the one parent that loved me? Take her, but don't take him. And you already did, you know? So I was mad at God. And a deep resentment in a young child grieving, that was enough to put me over the top, you know? And I ran away. I put my brother's backpack from Boy Scouts on me. I put some clothes in there. And you know what? I left. And my mother said, you know, you sleep in it. You know, the old line, you know, make your bed, you sleep in it. She would never let me come home. And when I was 13 and a half years old, I ran away. And I lived on the streets for a while. And an uncle found me downtown one day, and he tried to kind of straighten me up and bring me up. And I was drinking. I was making deals with bartenders. I was creative. And I would get beer and stuff like that by cleaning the bathrooms at the bar. Or I'd go and I'd show them that I could cook. Some of them would let me cook in the back of the restaurant to do dishes, and they'd give me some money. And, you know, down there in Seattle, there's a lot of liberal people in Seattle, which I'm very grateful for at the time, because because there was a lot of teen centers for homeless back then, and there were people that cared about me and took care of me while I was drinking myself literally to death. And what I did is I would take advantage of anything they had, from food to clothing or any kind of shelter they could provide. But most of the time we lived in abandoned buildings and just drank like fools. And that's kind of how I kind of raised myself up, starting to live like an animal and act like an animal. And I wasn't in school anymore. And eventually, one of the case managers there got me back in school. And by the time I was about 16 years old, I was probably qualified for AA. I was a daily drinker. I started to get the flu, I thought, a lot. I was getting the flu. My hands would shake and sweat and stuff. And I was like, God, I'm always sick, you know. And then this older guy that lived downtown, he said, you're not sick. You're sick with alcohol, but you're not sick with the flu. And that scared me, you know. I didn't want withdrawal. I was afraid that was going to happen to me. That was going to be like those old, you know, pee in the pants drunks downtown. Scared me, you know. So I had to find a way out, and I knew that education was the way. My family always pushed education. Got to go to college. Got to make something yourself. And that woman, she helped me. She got me on a contest, and I wrote an essay, and I won a chance to apply to a very good school in California. And I won the contest, and it was the night before I was supposed to get on a bus. And I had my housing stipend in my pocket, and I went to the Green Dolphin. Anybody been there? And I had a couple of beers, and I started to shoot some pool for money. And 3 days later, I ended up in Dallas, Texas, from Seattle, Washington. And I was in a van with six people I'd never met in my life that I could tell you about. I was in an outright blackout for 3 days. I don't know what happened. And we were driving down the freeway, and it said Dallas, and I said, drop me off here, I know people, which I didn't. I was terrified. And I just remember coming to like that sometimes and wondering, like, whose arm is on my chest or where I was. And those kind of things started to happen. And I was too embarrassed to call the school. I was too embarrassed to let them know, you know, I'm 2,000 miles away from where I'm supposed to be in California to go to college. And by the way, I'm an alcoholic and I need help. I couldn't do it. So I would just make some funny joke like, oh, I don't like those tree-hugging hippies in California anyway, you know. I'd find something wrong with that. That's why I couldn't do it, you know. And then I'd ended up working for like 6 weeks in a restaurant, and a woman let me sleep on the floor of the restaurant, and I went home. And home for me was just another man, a guy with a leather jacket, you know, that I met at a bar. And, you know, he was always in the bathroom. I thought he must have a colon problem, but it was actually a cocaine problem. I didn't know. But He introduced me to a way in which my drinking changed. And I think, you know, we talk a lot about controlling our drinking. I was already trying to control my drinking before I was even 21 years old. I was already trying to pull back and not drink as often, like maybe just a couple of nights a week. And then when I did drink, I would drink too much, and then I beat myself up. And so I met this wonderful guy that always, you know, was available to me to have all these, you know, shenanigans that I could use. And I started using the cocaine, and what it did for me, it just immediately allowed me to drink more, and it took me down as quick. I'm glad almost that today I can say I'm glad that that was my experience, that I was trying to mix things together to make it still work for me, because by the time I was 20, 21 years old, you know, I was starting to get involved in very serious things. I'd already had my mother's house robbed, and it was really the garage that we robbed, because there were all kinds of tools from my father in the garage, and, you know, I got to split half the money with the guy that robbed me. My mother for me. Those are the kind of things I started to do, going in parking lots and street scamming. I'm sure none of you people have ever done anything like that. So I started to get a name around town, like all the police officers knew me. You know, it wasn't a good look. I'd get everything I ate was usually a free pizza, because I would scam a free pizza to eat. I learned all those wonderful skills living on the streets of downtown Seattle. And so that was the way I was. And if I wasn't scamming, I was drinking. And if I wasn't drinking, I was scamming. And, you know, I was starting to have those moments where I'd walk by a mirror and I couldn't look. I couldn't look at myself. And I'd think to myself how much I wanted to stop, and I'd want to get back to school. And I was, like, infatuated with school, I guess, and so I'd apply for another school. And I would try for a couple of weeks. I'd get in. Sometimes I'd get some, like, you know, maybe a grant or a loan or something, and I'd get into school, and I'd go for, like, you know, 3 weeks hard, you know. And then I would meet somebody. It was like I had something on my head that said, I drink, do you? You know what I mean? It was just like I could pick them out of a crowd, like, oh, let's – I would date Lloyd, or you know, I'd go to John's house, and I wouldn't come back for 3 weeks from school. You know, just I'd live with John. I'm just kidding, but you know what I mean. That's what would happen. You know, that's how I got my boyfriend in college. I just met him, and I lived with it. I never went home. You know. You know the old joke about people in AA, when we date, we just have a U-Haul and we just drive up, you know? So, you know, that's kind of how it was. But that was before AA. So long story, you know, kind of shortened. But my drinking was progressing and I could see it already, and I hadn't even gotten to be 22 years old, and I'm starting to hate myself. And my mom didn't ask ever for me to come anymore. The last Thanksgiving I'd spent at home, my grandma pretty much fell asleep in the plate of food. I mean, not on purpose like crazy, but like just nodding at the table. And I was so mad because I had, you know, couldn't get any more wine, and I didn't have any more money, and we kept doing other things to keep us postponed from doing it, going and getting more wine and bringing the wine. That was my whole job. I had, like, you know, my mom calls me at 2, bring the wine. I'm supposed to be there at 4, right? I got 2 hours to buy wine and get 3 minutes away. You know, I can't do it. I end up doing a bunch of blow, so I end up coming at 8 o'clock at night to Thanksgiving, and I bring a man with hair down to his butt and all these tattoos everywhere, so my mom can't say anything, you know? And my mom just looks at me and she says, really? This is what you're gonna do, you know, on Thanksgiving? And she just started going into the kitchen and started folding, you know, foil up and making packages for me so I'd have something to eat. And that was the last year I saw my grandma alive. So those are the memories that you can't get back. Those are the things that we do to our family, you know? And my mom always worried about me eating, you know? And then there was a day when I did call her probably another year later, and I asked for money, and I had a ring on my finger that was my grandmother's. And I said, I'm gonna sell this ring, threatening my mother, you know. And she said, well, you know, if you need to eat, Grandma would understand. But I'm not going to feed you anymore. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't sell that ring. But later on, 2 more years, I was able to sell that ring quickly. And some people's furniture that I was sitting on as well. That's a whole other story. But yeah, I went to somebody's house to get something, and they didn't come back on my time. I'm sure that's nothing like you guys. And when they didn't come back, I sold their furniture. Yeah, I had to make an amend for that. I did. I really had to amend that financially. It's very embarrassing. But so here I am, 24, 25 years old, get fired from a 7-Eleven. Now, if you want to get fired from a 7-Eleven, drink their beer, steal a case of their, or a carton of their cigarettes, and then at 6 a.m. be as high as a kite and be sitting on the floor of the store and customers standing waiting for you, and I'm turning the beers, facing them all forward, and I'm smoking in the store drinking a beer. Yeah, 6 a.m., nice look. So needless to say, the 7-Eleven Corporation won't hire me, and but that was my last job. You know, I was 24 years old. That was the last time I worked. So 3 years pass, and like, I don't know, when you're out there, 3 months seems like a blink of an eye. And 3 more years continued, and I continued to drink like that. And I wanted death. I wanted to go out hard and fast. I wanted to punish my family. I wanted them to know it was their fault I was like this. And I wanted them to feel sorry for me. I mean, I was really, really mad, and I wanted them to feel bad about what had happened to poor Susie, you know? And, you know, I kept pouring drinks down me every time I was, you know, feeling so sorry. And people would say, so why are you so upset today, Susie? But my father died. And they were like, oh, when was that? You know, 20 years ago, you know? But the thing was that I was always looking for a circumstance for my drinking. It had to be because I got fired at work, or it was because the boyfriend left, or... But you know what? I was drinking because I have a physical allergy and a mental obsession. I can't not drink. That's the truth. I can't not drink. And you know, I have those mental blank spots where I can't remember a week or a month ago. I don't remember last Friday when they put me in jail because I was at the Hilton pretending I was a client and I wasn't. And I was, you know, at the swimming pool and I was stealing a wallet out of the women's locker room. That can be a problem. And, you know, they hauled me off. They hogtied me and took me in. And it's the only time I ever went to jail myself was that night. And, you know, I'm really grateful that I can say today that one of the best places for me is jail, because I need to be there all the time. I need to be reminded of that opportunity that I've been given to walk out of that jail today. So I spent a lot of time doing service with jails and prisons. I've been doing it since for years. And it's been the greatest gift to help me be not just reminded that I could be like that, but those people that are there, most of them have done way less than most of us. And there's a path in there for them as well. And I've seen miraculous things in prisons and jails, people in jail helping other people stay alive. It's a beautiful thing. So back to my story really quickly. 27 years old, no friends, no family. Third time I tried to go to school, I now have stolen money from 3 colleges and have no education. Right? I'm not wanted anywhere. I can't even get a job at a 7-Eleven. My boyfriend really doesn't want me. He likes the drug dealer better than me. They're in the bathroom, and I've been in this beat-up old Thunderbird trailer. I mean, this is like really old school, one single wide trailer in the back of the trailer park where nobody wants to be, but it's like all the beat-up old trailers that they're going to sell someday. That's where I lived. So we lived in this trailer for about a week, and my boyfriend, he was a kind of like a homemade electrician. He wasn't legal or anything. He shouldn't be working around it. But he knew a lot from working for like probably 10 days at a phone company, so he learned how to hook stuff up. So he ran a wire and hooked up to another trailer, you know? So we had phone service, and that was very important if you're in my business. And so so we're in this beat-up old trailer, and there's, you know, just tons of blankets, filthy, dirty blankets. I couldn't tell you where they were from, who had them, what was, never mind. You don't even want to think about it. But I'm laying in these blankets, and I've been getting pretty much loaded for 2 days straight, maybe 3, the morning of the third day, and the sun's coming up, and there's birds chirping, and I am, like, sick because I have so much fluid in my body from doing IV drugs and drinking. And I can't function. I can't get up. I can't walk. I'm just, like, really, really sick. And I'm laying there, and the sun comes up, and I'm thinking, not another day. I don't want to do another day, and I couldn't kill myself. I even tried a couple of times, and I'm just not good at that for some reason. And I couldn't do it. And finally, I see this man and woman in there in the nice part of the trailer park, and the guy gets his baby, and he kisses the baby, and he brings the baby to his girlfriend or wife, and I think to myself, I'll never have that. I'll never have a family. I'll never have a husband. I'll never have a baby. Dear God, help me. And I mean, it was just like, it was not a prayer. I had not prayed to God since my father's death. I had not thought about going into church. I didn't even go and watch a couple of my friends. I didn't go to their funeral and memorials because I wouldn't go inside a church. But I said, dear God, help me. And I sat there for a couple of minutes, and strangest thing happened. I heard a voice, and it said, pick up the phone. And it was like it was behind me, and I didn't know there was no one there. And I'm thinking, great, now I'm hearing voices. Great, they're right. The people at the hospital, they're right. I'm going to start hearing voices. And then I heard it again. Susie, pick up the phone. And as I looked straight down that hallway, I could see a cord. And back, if you're really old like me, they had cords, and you could pull the cord, and the phone was there. And I pushed 0, and an actual operator answered and said, can I help you? And I said, please help me. I'm killing myself. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm dying. And she said, oh, honey, you're going to be okay. And she just started to talk to me. And she said, so what's going on? What are you doing? What's happening? And then have you ever overshared to somebody and then all of a sudden just all starts tumbling out. And I'm putting things in my arms and then I'm doing stuff I shouldn't do. And I robbed my mother and my dog's gone. And, all that's coming out. And I overshare, and then I stop, and I put the phone down and hang up, because that's smart, right? And I sit there, and I think, all right, the SWAT team's going to come, because she's going to call them. I'm crazy, and they're going to call the SWAT team. So I scream to my boyfriend, the cops are coming! And so there's no toilet available, if you know what I mean. So he runs out the door with the female drug dealer. Now, needless to say, he'd been telling me he's going to marry me for 9 of the 10 years we were together. Now, I'm still not married, had no ring, by the way, but he's with the female drug dealer out the door, and I never saw him again. Probably a good thing. But he leaves, and I'm just sitting there, and all of a sudden, like, nobody comes. And I'm a little disappointed. And And then this weird kind of peace, like I thought, you know, well, maybe I can go to jail and I can just kind of stop some of this. And then I got this thought, like, there's probably enough junk in the carpet, I could probably go to prison, because there probably was, you know? They could get enough in the carpet. And I thought, maybe I'll just go to prison, and then I could really stop. Maybe I could be done. And that was such a great thought, you know? And then the phone rang, and I was, oh, there they are, SWAT team's here, you know? They call, I didn't know that, but they don't really call. But I picked up the phone, and this man said, I'm with King County Detox. Is there anyone there that wants to get well today? And that's what he said, well today. And I'd never been talked to like that. Like today when we do a 12-step call, we're so kind. We're like, can I get you an Uber and a breakfast sandwich, honey? You know? And like he was like, if you want to get well, you got 30 minutes to claim that bed or I'll give it to somebody that wants it. Nobody had ever talked to me like that. And it was like early in the morning on a Sunday. And I'm thinking, I can't get anywhere. Now, I can get anywhere for some more of you-know-what anything, right? I can get some more drugs, more drinks, more men. I can get anywhere across town, no problem. Oh, can I get to detox? Oh, I don't know, you know? So, there's no bus, right? You know, I'm thinking this in my head, you know? And all of a sudden, I just turned and I put the phone down and said, I'm going to try. And I put the phone down, and there was a bottle of Old English, and I grabbed the bottle of Old English, and I'll never forget, I started walking up the street. And as soon as I turned from where I was and what I was doing, I got up to the street, and I mean, buses don't come on a Sunday in Seattle very often, like once every 3 hours. And the bus just glided up and stopped, and the doors opened, and he said, where are you going? And he could see the bottle of Old English in my hand. I said, I'm going to detox. He said, drink it in the back. And he let me drink that, you know, all the way down in the back. You know, I was so grateful. He let me drink it. I needed it to get to detox that day, I believed. Now, that may not have been true, but that's how I believed. You know, and I put the bottle in the garbage, and I turned from there. I could have left, but I got into detox. I walked in there, and I said, I'm killing myself. I need help. I really need help. And then you see all the, like I said, the pee in the pants drunks and all the other people that are way worse than you and the crazy people. And I'm like, might have overreacted, you know? I was just living in an abandoned trailer doing, you know, sick, but I'm fine, you know? I'm homeless, you know? But so anyway, I'm trying to backtrack a little bit, and the doctor takes me in there, and I had 4 teeth left on the roof of my mouth. I weighed 89 pounds with all my clothes on. I was a size 00, and I thought I was hot, if you know what I mean. I wasn't, apparently. I thought different. We all do. Being that skinny is pretty frightening. And so I was really sick, and he said, you're dying of alcoholism. And I was highly offended. My mother was dying of alcoholism, not me. You know what I mean? Because I knew what an alcoholic looked like. She looked like an alcoholic. I'm just a young person drinking too much, partying too much, and I have a bad boyfriend. Let's face it, you know? And so that was how I was thinking there. And he looked at me and he said, you have malnutrition and your liver's swollen from cocaine. It's great. It's grace that you're here. And I was like, ugh, I didn't want to hear that, you know. So then they didn't know what to do with me because I had sores in my throat and I couldn't swallow. They give you a peanut butter sandwich at detox. How dumb is that? Couldn't even swallow it, you know. So I had this peanut butter sandwich, and they roll me in a wheelchair because I'm very unstable. I don't know why. Maybe it was all the drinks I had, but I'm very unstable. And I go into the AA meeting, and it's over with. And this girl is talking to another woman, and the girl's talking. And then the woman says, you know, I haven't had a drink or a drug in 10 years. I'm free. And I went, that's crap. And she just looked at me. She said, and what's your name? And you hate that, you know? And I said, Susie. And she said, Susie what? I said, back then it was Susie Derrick. And she goes, Susie, are you done for good and all? Have you had enough yet? Nobody ever asked me anything like that. I said, I guess. I'm here, you know, because I'm so smart. I'm here. And she said, are you willing to go to any lengths in Alcoholics Anonymous to stay alive? And I said, I'll try. And then she said, are you willing to believe in God? And I was like, oh, here we go. Sundresses and churches, you know, all that. I can't do that. I can't dance. Nothing's going to, I can't smoke. Can't be with guy. Oh, no, we're not going. You know, that's what's all going on up here. And she said, stop. Group of drunks, good orderly direction. Can you do either of those? And I said, sure, I can do that. Group of drunks. I'll take that one. Door number two, you know. And she came across the room, and I'm thinking, there's all these nice businessmen in suits there at the meeting, all cleaned up like you people, which I love to see, by the way. It's nice to see y'all dress up for AA like the old days. But they were all in business suits and nice clothing. The women smelled good. The cars weren't dented in the parking lot. We could see through the barred windows. You know, it was wonderful. And, you know, that was, it was like, I thought maybe one of those men would get me. Do you know what I mean? Like not a prize, but like, you know, maybe help me a little, get a phone number. And she comes up across the room with this piece of paper. I'm like, great, it's her number. Wonderful. You know, that's what I'm thinking. And it wasn't even a phone number. It was an address to her home group. And that's where I went 2 days later. I got out. And I remember I had a chance to turn and get on that same bus and go back to where the trailer was, where my 10-year boyfriend that was never going to marry me was, that I was hoping he still would. But I thought about it. And again, I turned. And as soon as I turned away from what I was doing, I didn't know at the time I was turning toward God. And I turned toward, you know, getting on a bus and going to Auburn, Washington. And I went to that home group, and I showed up there at 7 o'clock. And she looked like this and kind of gave me the finger to come in here, sit down. And she worked with me 3 nights a week for almost 10 weeks. And I worked the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she read that book out loud to me. When she started to read, I explained to her, I'd been to 3 of the best colleges in the country. She said, no, you stole money from 3 of the best colleges. And then, so she was very clear with me. I needed somebody very direct. You know, I needed someone to tell the truth about me. If your sponsor's not telling the truth to you about yourself, they should never be mean or hurtful. But I need the truth. I have plenty of friends. I don't need another friend. I need the truth so that I can really begin to see what I need and where I need to go and how I can do it. I need to accept help, and the help only comes when I hear the truth. So she started telling me the truth really quickly, and it was painful because nobody ever had, you know? And I always walked away from anything that was anything good or anything strong or any kind of discipline or any kind of people telling me what to do. I don't know about you, but I don't like authority much. I was the authority personally, you know. I liked it when y'all listened to me, but that didn't go well often. And so, like, she just showed me in the book actual action. She had me come to the home group an hour and 15 minutes early, which I thought was so stupid. Why on earth, you know? And then she'd have me go with this guy named Charlie and put the chairs up, and I'd line the chairs up, and then when I would walk over to go get a cup of coffee, Charlie would run over there and reline them the way they should be, you know? And, you know, that's what we did for months on end while I started going through the book. And little crazy things that start to happen, like, you know, I didn't have a whole lot of money, and I didn't really know where I was going to live after this little, like, they had a 21-day spin treatment program I was in. And then I went to, like, an Oxford house, which is, I don't know if they have them down here, but halfway house kind of thing. And it was 9 months, and so I knew if I could do that, I might have a chance of staying alive. And a woman just from the AA meeting helped me get there, and then I had no money, so another lady from AA let me go paint her and her husband's new home. And I'd never held a paintbrush in my life, I don't think, you know, maybe in kindergarten, but they taught me how to paint, and they paid me money so that I could get groceries, and just crazy things started to happen. And I started going to the meeting every day, because not just because I had nothing better to do, but because I wanted what you had. I knew you were telling the truth. I could hear a God in your story that I wanted to know but didn't know how to find. And I knew it was real, and I desperately wanted to be different. I hurt so bad. And, you know, I'm so glad that I didn't have any medicine on board, that they weren't handing out a bunch of pills at a crazy hospital or something, because I'd still be there. I had gone to a psychiatrist years before, and they diagnosed me everything from schizoid to psychotic. And it was all because I didn't tell the truth. I could not tell the truth to those medical professionals. And so I'm so glad early on my sponsor just said, let's let things shake out. If you're not suicidal, let's work the steps and see what happens to you. And you know what? By the grace of God, I've never had to take anything else other than that. And that's not everyone's story. But I want you to know that's a lot of our stories. And when I got done working, it was maybe 11, week 10 or 11. And, you know, I got sober through the holidays, and it's always very special to me because I had nowhere to go. No family wanted anything to do with me, period. No even extended relative that had heard my name wanted anything to do with me. So I would be at the Alkathons. And I would eat two or three times because, you know, I was always hungry. I know why. I was, you know, starving. But I would eat all day long and sleep at the Alkathons in between the meetings. But at least I had somewhere to go. And what I noticed is some of the strong members of AA, they had families, they had jobs, they had beautiful homes and cars. And they would come in still. And sometimes they'd bring their children. And they'd come to a meeting and attend it and sit with us because they remembered the day they didn't have any of those things. And I, to this day, I always, like, go and make breakfast for the Healing Place, which is in my town, it's a big, like, 180-bed treatment center that's free in town. And I go and make breakfast at 4 o'clock in the morning on Christmas. That's my ultimate favorite thing to do, you know. And, like, those kind of acts of service, like, they showed me what to do if and when I got a life. And they continued to come back. They didn't pick up what they could at AA and left with it out the door, hoping to keep it for themselves. They keep bringing that beautiful life in, and they introduced me to their children, and they showed me how to raise a child, because I met a guy in an AA meeting, shocking, after I worked the steps, who knew? And the first guy I met, he wanted a little arrangement that I wasn't very fond of anymore because I had some value and morals. So that didn't work well. And then I met another guy, and he was willing to court me and date me. I know that's a weird saying. I thought it was weird, too, but that's what my sponsor said he was doing. That he actually, what was going on is I dated him with my clothes on. It's really odd. And what happened, he stayed. It was the strangest thing. And, you know, 2 years later, we got married, and our, you know, the whole wedding was a sober wedding. It was an amazing thing. And, you know, about 11 months later, I got pregnant. And that next year, you know, I had a beautiful baby boy. And the funny thing is I had an abortion, and I don't know why I'm mentioning this, when I was 18 years old, and I remember extreme pain from that and feeling forced into having to go through that. And it's I'm not going to talk anything other than saying that it was horrific for me. I always carried it as just something that just leveled my spirit, and I felt unforgiven. And so when I got newly sober, I ended up with cancer that first year. I had cervical cancer, and it was a grace of God that I went to a doctor, and they found it, and they cured me, basically. But they told me I'd never have a child. And then within 4 years, I had this beautiful baby boy. And so God continued to bless me every time I turned toward him. And it was just miraculous. Like, I mean, I'm not any kind of great saint. I'm not the best example always. I'm just a human trying to live in this world and be better than I was yesterday. But here I am having this wonderful family, and I learned to take that little boy because you guys showed me how to pray with them, not just at meals, but help them when they're in school. Like when he would even be in kindergarten and some kid would be mean to him, pray for Charlie, help Charlie not to be so mean, you know, and my son would begin to pray like that. And when we drive in the car, an ambulance would come by, and Sean would make me pull over and pray because we're taught not to do things in the car but drive, right? So I have to pull over every time my kid wants to pray. You know, it was terrible. And then by the time my son, you know, was like 12 or something, you know, he was doing coat drives, and he had seen so much service in my home because I had women coming in there. Sometimes I'd have, you know, 5 or 8 a week. I'd meet these girls and take them through the book. And when Sean was little, he had his own little AA book. But later on, he started doing service on his own. He started the first service club at his high school. You know, that stuff, those principles, I had to unlearn principles. I had to stop doing old behavior and then begin to hear about principles in the traditions and learn to live that way. My son, he just grasped those principles and went with them. It was miraculous to watch. And that's what our children do if they're not exposed to those old behaviors. They don't have to unlearn anything. They get the gift of getting all this and moving forward with it. My son had a better relationship with God. At 17, he wanted to go to Johns Hopkins, and I was like, yeah. everybody wants to go to Johns Hopkins, Sean. You know, come on, you know. I was like, you know. And he wasn't the smartest kid in this class. I'm just going to say it. Don't tell him I said that. But he wasn't. And he didn't have the top grade. You know, he didn't. But he believed that it was possible with God. Who kept saying that all the time? All things are possible. Why did I say that, you know? Because I began to believe it. He goes before us always. God goes before us. So here I am at the top of the stairs. I'm here. I'm in my home, the one I own, which I was homeless to homeowner by this point in my life. You know, my son's 17 years old, and I own a home. I have a life. I have a job. I have a family. I have tons of women and men in my life. I have a huge AA foundation. Everything's going well. And my son is in his room praying, and I hear, "Dear God, I'd really like to go to Johns Hopkins, but anywhere you can place me will be perfect." I don't pray that good. And 2 weeks later, he gets a text, because I guess that's how they do it now. And he gets a text, and he says, "Oh, my God, I got in." And we both hit our knees. We didn't hug each other first. We went to God first. And we thanked God, and then we hugged. And then I cried, because I thought, how are we going to pay for it? You know? You know, I wasn't wealthy. I kind of dumb. I went into social work, which was not bright, but that's what I did. And I just kept praying, then God show us what we can do. And the school gave $30,000 for $56,000 a year, which really isn't helpful. It's kind of a tease, you know. So long story short, that was what happened. But my son, someone else that had gone to school there, heard of his situation, and they said, "You keep a 3.6, and we'll pay for you. We'll give you a full ride." And he went to Johns Hopkins for free. And I paid just for the room and board, which is enough for me. That was all I could afford. But God gave me even the money. There were times in my sobriety where I was really penniless. We didn't have much. I was married to somebody that couldn't work. That's a whole other story. And I was able to divorce that man many years later sober by principle. And I mean, we're talking serious principle, like still being kind, still being thoughtful, still making meals for him, being kind, taking him to doctors. I mean, I did all those things, not because I'm a good person, because I wanted to stay sober and do right action. And today, you know, we've not ever made our son have 2 birthdays or 2 Christmases or 2 graduations or any of that crazy stuff. I go where he goes. I sit next to that man. If there's anything that when Sean got his white coat when he was a doctor, you know, when he graduates from his residency program, we'll both be there. And I'm so grateful that I have the capacity to do that. I can be around people I don't like. I can be loving, and I can be true. I couldn't be like that before. I have always had sponsorship. I've always worked with tons and tons of women and men. I'm so grateful to be here. I know my story got just different this time. I don't know why. Maybe some of y'all needed to hear the first part more. But what I want to tell you is continue to believe. Every time you turn away from what you were doing, God is with you. So thank you.